This is the moment for people to take their power back. This midterm election, there has to be consequences. We have to see ourselves as founders of a new America.
Hey, what's up, fam? From Futuro Media and PRX, it's In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture. I'm Maria Hinojosa, solo hosting today while Julio is out, which means we got the queens in the house. Based in Atlanta, Georgia, yes, Queen Latasha Brown, co-founder at Black Voters Matter, is joining us. Hey, Latasha.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, honey. And from New York City, another queen, Dr. Christina Greer, associate professor of political science at Fordham University and co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. Welcome back, Chrissy.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
And so it's noisy in the background, just so you all know. There may be some little puppy noises because, yes, I'm a new mother of a puppy. It's been bringing me a lot of happiness, which is good because right now I'm feeling a kind of particular sadness. And I think a lot of us are. This is news that came out from Minneapolis. Amir Locke, 22 years old, sleeping when he was shot by Minneapolis police last week when they carried out a no-knock search warrant that his name wasn't even on. He had permit to carry a gun, but they shoot him immediately. It's horrible. Over the weekend, hundreds of protesters marched through the streets of Minneapolis demanding justice. So we're going to start with a temperature check, which is, so how are you doing? How are you feeling in general? And Latasha, what's your temperature check? How you doing?
I'm sad. I'm disappointed. I'm angry. You know, and there's a part of me that is actually hopeful. And so I'm holding a lot right now, but just in this recent murder, and we need to call it what it is, it was a murder.
Yes.
Are we at this point in this nation that the police are giving so much unchecked power that they can actually kill a Black man, Black woman, Black people that are sleeping? You know, part of what I am feeling is, how do we move past this point where we're not in this circumstance anymore?
Yeah, I'm feeling that too. Chrissy, how you doing? Give us your temperature check.
Yeah, it's just, it's exhausting in the sense that, you know, you think about so many young Black men and Black women who don't want to end up being a hashtag. We know that Black people who have legal guns never get the support of the NRA. But I think that it is just, it's a heavy burden to know that Black people are not safe in their own homes, sleeping on someone's couch, in their own beds, worshiping at a church, driving in their own car, walking down the sidewalk, walking into a shop. There's just no place in this country for us to ever be fully free.
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. It doesn't seem as though there's enough outrage because it happens so often. These hashtags, that's still just heartbreaking because we know that a loss of a life, especially in this circumstance, isn't just hard on the family. It's hard on an entire community. And it's hard on little boys and girls who see this on the news and they wonder if it could one day be them.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's just the epitome of what happens in the dehumanizing of a Black man or a Black woman's body, in that in their sleep, they are not free from this kind of violence. So I don't want to say may he rest in peace, because Amir Locke should be alive. Only 22 years old, and we're holding space for him and his family. And you know what, Minneapolis? Clean your shit up. I'm sick of this. Minnesota nice and all this. No, enough. All right, so now we're going to move on to another difficult topic. Latasha, when you just joined the show, I said to you, you know, how you doing? I was like, well, I'm a little bit freaked out and sad and scared about the democracy. And you said,
I was like, maybe we can create a real one.
So maybe we can create a real democracy, because right now what we are dealing with is worthy of being terrified. But that doesn't make us become inactive, right? It pushes us. So we're going to get to the latest with January 6th. This past Friday, former Vice President Mike Pence publicly rejected Trump's claims that he could have overturned the election. Also on Friday, the Republican National Committee, RNC, formally censored GOP representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. The resolution stated it was because they were, quote, they were participating in a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse. They are saying that January 6th is legitimate political discourse. And, you know, we do talk about people power, but what we saw on January 6th was a violent attempted coup d'etat. It remains an attempted coup d'etat to overturn a legitimate election. So on Friday, Matthew Dowd, a political consultant who is formerly a Republican, was on Joanne Reed's show on MSNBC talking about the state of the Republican Party. So let's take a quick listen.
And I think the days of blaming this on Donald Trump, we have to stop.
Yes.
I mean, Donald Trump is obviously a proximate cause, but Donald Trump was basically a reflection of who the Republican Party is as opposed to a cause of it. It's like saying Jefferson Davis was the reason why the state seceded. No, the state seceded because the people in the states wanted to secede, and he just happened to run the show after they seceded in this. And so to me, that's what's a reflection. And one of the things, having worked in the Republican Party in an ever so brief time that I did with George W. Bush, the RNC, these people, I keep this in mind, is the people most in touch with who the Republican Party base is. The RNC is closest to the Republican Party activists and the Republican Party grassroots. So when they put out a statement like that, they're a complete reflection of the Republican Party base in this. And the unicorns like Adam Kinzinger and what Mitt Romney said today and Liz Cheney, they're the complete exception to the rule in this. And you know you're in a bad place when the person today who has moral fiber in the Republican Party is Mike Pence.
Okay. He just laid it out pretty quickly. So Chrissy, your reaction to the gaslighting from the RNC?
What I think is so shameful for the Republican Party is that on January 7th of 2021, you saw Republican leader after Republican leader denouncing what they saw. They saw the same swastika flags we saw. They saw the Confederate flags. They saw these insurrectionists beating police officers and terrorizing our nation's capital. And they denounced it. And then fast forward a year, we've gone from we cannot have this. This is not democracy. This is not who we are as American people, to this is peaceful protests. And Democrats are just trying to use this as a wedge issue. And they're making a tempest out of a teapot. And we just need to all go back to business as usual, ignoring the fact that police officers have died by suicide because of what they experienced on January 6, 2021. And so the fact that the Republican Party has essentially thrown down the gauntlet and said, we are now the party of white nationalists. We are now the party of insurrectionists. We are now the party that rejects small d democratic principles, even at the cost of the safety of the nation. That's who they are. And so before, when we would say this, Maria, you and I, and Latasha would say it much more eloquently when it came to voting rights, you know, we were accused of being extremists. We were accused of being alarmists and histrionic. And now we have visual evidence of these individuals trying to overthrow the government at the behest of, at the time, a sitting president. And we have members of the Republican Party, a vast majority now of members of the Republican Party, saying it wasn't that big of a deal. This committee is just a witch hunt. This is so damaging and so frightening for the future of our democracy that if we don't cut this off at the head soon, before the midterms, I would argue, that we're in a really dangerous position to see where this country actually goes in the next few years.
So, Latasha, how do you take that with the hope that you have, which is, you know, we can use this moment to build a true democracy, but it's like they ain't trying to build shit.
No.
They're trying to tear everything down.
I agree with everything that Chrissy said. When she was talking, it reminded me of the image of the gremlins. You remember the gremlins?
Oh, God.
Seemed like they're all furry and harmless, and then water gets on them at midnight and they turn into these monsters. The Republicans have always been that, but they used to at least have the furry component. You know, they've decided that they're going to be the party of white fear, of white supremacy, and of white consolidated anti-democratic control. And I think we have to really recognize that there are more of us in this country that have a vision of a real, true America. There are more of us in this country that respect diversity. There are more of us in this country that are literally communities of color. When you look at where the projected growth in this country, it is from our communities. And so we have to recognize that it is really the moment for us to forge a vision of a new America, a kind of America where it's multiracial, it's multigenerational. And so in this moment where it is extremely painful, we can no longer hide behind American exceptionalism mm-hmm. and operate that as if America's democracy, as is laid out in the Constitution and Declaration of Independence, hasn't been achieved. I'm saying this is the moment for people to take their power back. This midterm election, we've got to send a message loud and clear that that is not the direction that we're going to go. That's not the direction we want to go. We also have to see ourselves a little bit differently. We have to see ourselves as founders of a new America. Mm-hmm. Yes, we should be honest in this moment and say, this is hell what we're experiencing right now. The democracy that we have is being dismantled.
Right.
But we also have to take it a step further and literally get people engaged and say, what is possible
right.
when people are showing up in the fullness of their power and they're relentless and they're resilient?
I'm feeling it. Now, the problem that I'm having, as you can imagine, is that our colleagues in the news media, they're just like, well, you know, and so the RNC said this and this and that. And it's like our hair is on fire. And they're still kind of approaching this in a way that is, you know, both sides of it all. And that's what makes it scary. And that's why, Latasha, what you're doing and the way you're framing it and the work that you do on a daily with Black Voters Matter, which, thank you, I really needed to hear it all. So last week, a lawsuit that Black Voters Matter is part of went up to federal court. It's against a Florida voter suppression law, and it restricts drop boxes. It restricts voting by mail and third-party groups that register voters, among other things. Something else that happened last week, a Black Lives Matter activist in Memphis, Tennessee, Pamela Moses, was sentenced to six years. It's insane. She cannot serve, not even one day. 6 years in prison for attempting to vote. Now, Moses had a prior felony conviction on her record, but she had taken all of the steps. She was documenting everything so that she would do it legally. And because the records people basically messed up, she's the one who got arrested and is now charged.
Right.
Let's listen to Trymaine Lee. He's the host of the Into America podcast, and he was recently on Zerlina Maxwell's show to talk about the racist history of voter suppression.
Think about then as now the kind of racialized politics, right, that fuel much of how we participate in the process. You think about the painting of Black politicians and Black voters as inept, perhaps undeserving, right, unworthy of the power of the vote. You think about all of the voter suppression efforts from voter ID laws to diminishing, Black voting districts, right? Eliminating early voting, Sunday voting. These all harken back to those days after the Civil War when the idea of Black people harnessing their political power was too dangerous for America to take. And we saw the backlash. And again, there's no real disconnect. We're kind of on a continuum. The roots and the seeds of which we saw happen in Reconstruction, we're seeing playing out today.
So, Latasha, how do you see it in terms of anti-Black racism and voter suppression? I mean, it's straight up. But how do you process this as someone who is trying to deconstruct this?
I think what we need to really recognize is that we're in a bloodless civil war. Those radical racists attacked the Capitol on January 6th last year. They were declaring war on the nation. They were walking through the halls of the nation capital with Confederate flags. Mm-hmm. Part of being the problem of this country is that things have the appearance of getting better, but the root cause does not get uprooted. The bottom line is anti-Black racism is the source of all of the structural racism that is in this nation. And until we deal with that, until we uproot it, until we call it out, we will still see ourselves in this perpetual cycle, whether it's every 30 years, whether it's every 60 years. How would I expect this nation that actually for over 200 years dehumanized a group of people as if we were just a piece of property, mm-hmm. committed genocide on indigenous people. And we can talk about immigrants that were exploited, mm-hmm. you know, put in internment camps, Asian Americans. I can go on and on and on. Right. And so this is a country that in many ways has built wealth off the exploitation rooted in structural racism. And so we have to really take a moment right now to figure out how are we going to deal with the root cause, because that's what everything is growing out of. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always been three strategies around voter suppression.
All right. So, like, what are some examples?
First one is it's always about restricting access to the ballot, creating barriers that make it harder to vote, whether that's on the front end around voter registration, not allowing people to register, whether that's on literally once they register, then they've got a voter ID or they got massive closing of polling sites. But there's always a restriction around access. The second is always around creating a culture of fear. What we saw happen in Memphis, that sent a message of fear around the sleeping giant in this country, which are formerly incarcerated people. We saw this with the work that Desmond Meade has done to restore the voting rights of formerly incarcerated people down in Florida and what potential lies with that. Then the third has always been weaponizing the administrative process. Although it infringes upon civil rights, it infringes upon people's human rights. And so that is the playbook that they're using now. And then when people ask, oh my God, it's so overwhelming, how do you have hope? Listen, Maria, I am a Black woman who grew up in a place called Selma, Alabama. In Selma, Alabama, there were 600 Black people who did not have anywhere near the resources that many folks have now. Matter of fact, it was the norm of the day. They couldn't even drink water from a water fountain. And they knew that once they walked across that Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were going to be met with billy clubs, and they were going to be met with an enforcement agency who had the power to actually beat them merciless. Yet they persisted. I'm saying that because I want us to put things in perspective of how things change.
Right. Exactamente.
I'll go back to Georgia. 2018, that we had done tremendous this work, putting new voters on the voting rolls, organizations and groups on the ground. And as a result of the current governor, Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State at the time in Georgia, right before that election, he kicked off hundreds of thousands of voters, disproportionately voters of color. As a result, many of us feel that he stole that election. Do you know what we did? We took that anger and that frustration and we organized,
right,
redirected it to our power. And as a result, we literally were able to flip the state, not just in the presidential election, just to remind people, but in a runoff election where the whole runoff system was set up so that it would be a major drop off on Black voters. So my point is, in what we're going through right now, those two lessons should be instructive of where we are now. We need to take this frustration. We need to literally transform it into a directed power where people are saying, we believe in we the people.
From Futuro Media and PRX, Latino Rebels Radio is an award-winning OG Latino podcast, covering stories of the Latino experience that matter in the United States, the Caribbean, Central America, South America, and even parts of the universe. Lo que sea. Created for, about, and by Latinos, join us every Thursday by subscribing to Latino Rebels Radio, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chrissy, you wrote your latest op-ed in the New York Times about New York City Mayor Eric Adams.
Right.
You're basically saying, yes, and it gets more complicated, too. You wrote, quote, many Black Americans have a friend or a relative like Eric Adams, the new mayor of New York. We have uncles who bring up the progressive beliefs of Black Lives Matter in the same breath as the conservative talking points about black-on-black crime. We have relatives who are cops or former cops who do not want the police defunded, nor loved ones stopped, frisked, and mistreated by officers, end quote. Now, there was some pushback to this take online from some Black writers and activists about how one can be progressive while operating within a kind of white supremacist system. So, Chrissy, can you talk about the nuances that we miss when it comes to the complexity of Black governance and Eric Adams as the mayor of New York City? I'm still kind of, how do we talk about and further the nuances that we miss?
Right. And, you know, there are lots of people who were just saying, you know, he's definitely not progressive. You know, he's the worst person ever. It's like, well, obviously he's not the worst person ever because 50% of New Yorkers who bothered to turn out actually voted for him. And so the first question I would ask people who sort of have a serious problem with Eric Adams is, how many people actually bothered to vote? Because in New York, we have an abysmal voter turnout. And this is for the voting eligible population. So I would implore people who were dissatisfied with the new mayor, and I have lots of critiques that I've written about quite a bit in the griot, I would implore people to do all the heavy lifting that Latasha's been doing. It's actually not just vote, but bring several people to the ballot box to actually participate in your own democracy. Mm-hmm. I think the reason why I wrote that piece is because I've been really struggling with the fact that Eric Adams was not my choice for mayor. I think that he is very draconian in certain tactics that he wants to use. They remind me quite a bit of Rudy Giuliani or Ed Koch. I am definitely to the left of the mayor, but I'm trying to understand when I talk to, and not just older Black people, but when I talk to Black people who don't live in certain parts of Brooklyn or Manhattan, who want more policing or who are the police, whether civilian or uniformed. And so we've always been a complex voting bloc where we're not monolithic.
Yeah.
And we can look at problems from a multidimensional angle where there are homeowners who say, well, I don't want these kids on my stoop. I also don't want them roughed up for no reason when they're just walking to and from the store. And so it's an under-resourcing conversation that I'm hoping that blue-collar mayor like Eric Adams will have. I'm trying to be optimistic because obviously just a pylon is not helpful for anyone. I think that we have to be honest about, as Latasha was saying, what this country always has been, not just to Black people, but to non-whites and certain groups of whites over time, but also how are we contributing to making our own democracy? I think it is a daily set of choices and decisions that we make individually and collectively to move this country forward. The reason why I'm an educator is to try and get people off of the sidelines. There are lots of folks that have critiques, but they have to ask themselves, what have you done to contribute to your democracy? Even within the institutional constraints, we see that the work of people like you, people like Latasha, people all over the country are still investing in this nation and not just criticizing it. So that is my hope. But with Eric Adams, I think it's also a little nuanced because I have to recognize that he's an African-American mayor, only the second. And so there are lots of people who are looking at him who automatically think that he's going to fail, who automatically want him to fail, who automatically think he's not smart. Uh-huh. He's clearly smarter than most because he became the second Black mayor in the city of New York. I don't agree with a lot of his policy positions, but I do think that there's a segment of the population that will not even give him a chance to hear some of the conversations, the nuanced conversations that we know Black people are having. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I implore people to say, look at your text chains. I'm arguing with my family members all the time and different friends all the time who either want more or less policing on this continuum. I think that piece that was really hard to write was trying to just help people understand just because the Black Lives Matter crew may be a vocal faction of the Black population, that does not necessarily make them all of the population. You know, how was Joe Biden so successful in South Carolina?
Yeah.
So, you know, when we talk about progressivism, we have to recognize that a lot of Black people are really savvy voters and they understand the capacity of white people. We have to go to the ballot box thinking about not just what we want, right, but what this country is able to do in incremental change. And so I was just trying to sort of set the stage for a much more nuanced conversation because Eric Adams is not David Dinkins. He's not Hakeem Jeffries. He's not Cory Booker. He's not Barack Obama. He's a different type of 21st century politician that we have to understand a lot of Black people want and a lot of white people want him too. And so how can we then work with him in this type of system to get the most out of what we need as this multi-complex and multifaceted Black population?
Let's move on to our final segment, which is La Última y Nos Vamos, the last one before you go. Last call, last shot. And I want to tell the both of you, I want to be sitting down and actually doing a last call, last shot with the both of you one of these days, maybe in 2022, a girl can hope. So we're seeing books about race, gender, and sexuality being banned across the country, mostly by conservative parents, activists, and lawmakers through efforts often funded by wealthy donors like billionaire Charles Koch. In January, a Tennessee school board voted to remove Mouse, great book, it's a graphic novel about the Holocaust, from its curriculum. Another book that's been targeted is All Boys Aren't Blue, coming-of-age memoir about queer Blackness by George M. Johnson. And George Johnson was on Democracy Now! Last week and got into what the book bans are really all about. So let's take a quick listen.
This is not really a fight about book bans. I think what it is a notion to try and hold on to white purity and like the innocence of their children. And I think when you look at what's going on with the Voting Rights Act, when you look at what's going on with Roe v. Wade, when you look at what's going on with book banning, they all have similar ties to the fact that the demographic and the population is shifting and the population is becoming less and less white. And so realistically, what they are trying to do is put a stop on any place where you can fully see that demographic shift happening, which just happens to be publishing. There are more Black and Brown students, so there are more Black and Brown books in school systems. So anywhere where we're seeing the demographic of books change, or the demographics of voting change, or the demographics of rates of birth changing between Black and Brown and white women, you're seeing where they're putting these attacks. So I think that's really what this is. I don't really think it has as much to do with books as it has to do with ensuring that they condition the next generation around who their founders were and how great this country is, in the same way they condition mine and my parents and my grandparents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like Latasha was saying, it's all based on fear and the unmistakable fact that white people are increasingly becoming a minority in this country. So, Chrissy, you're an educator, you're in the classroom like me.
Right.
What do you think that these attacks on the curriculum and on banning of books are going to have for Black, Brown, and LGBTQ students? What are you worried about? Or are you also saying all these banned book clubs are going to appear and more people are going to be reading these books?
Well, that would be a positive byproduct, but I think it taps into something Latasha said a few minutes ago, which is we're not honest about who we are as a nation. And if you can take out these books about the role we played in the Holocaust as a nation, if we can take out these books about the role we played in U.S. chattel slavery, these are ways that we deny our history. We sort of sanitize it for white people, for white parents especially. And you've got someone like a Governor Youngkin who is just as bombastic and white nationalist as Donald Trump. The difference is he's got on a nice little Land's End vest mm-hmm. and he packages himself in a way that is palatable to people. Mm-hmm. But you know, this rise in banning of the books, which is not new, by the way, like we've always gone through this. Mm-hmm. But what it did remind me of, which is so insidious in this country, is I was watching the Bee Gees documentary because I do love the Brothers Gibb.
I love the Bee Gees too, Chrissy.
Me too.
Someone told me when I say that statement, I'm going to have a hallelujah chorus. But I watched that wonderful documentary on the Bee Gees. And what was so powerful was when they had a massive disco record burning at the White Sox Stadium in Chicago.
That's right.
There's a Black man in the documentary who was a young Black boy who was an usher at the time at the stadium. And he said what was so frightening and alarming about this disco banning, because if you brought a disco record to be burned, you could, you know, get a free ticket or something like that. And he said all the records that were being burned weren't disco records.
Wow.
It was Stevie Wonder and James Brown.
That's right.
Wow.
All these records are Black records that had nothing to do with disco. And of course, it turns into a riot
wow.
and a fire at the stadium. So supposed to be something fun. And it turned into essentially a racist rally against Blackness
wow.
and against Black music taking over the airwaves and taking over the musical purity of what is supposed to be white society. So we've seen this in so many different branches of our culture, not just books, but in music. You know, we had Luther Campbell go to the Supreme Court mm-hmm. when it came to Two Live Crew. And had he not won that case, the future of music would have been totally different. And so I think that we can't underestimate the extent to which so many people in this nation have fought for the preservation of white supremacy, anti-Blackness, patriarchy, and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Quadrant.
Mm.
So, Latasha, yes, yes.
And more yes.
More yes, right. Because, you know, interestingly, there's an organization called Libro Traficante, Book Trafficker, that what came up because they were doing the same thing in Arizona and in Texas. And they were like, oh, well, we're going to traffic the banned books. So take us out, Latasha, your thoughts on attacks on the books.
I believe, particularly as this book ban, it's too late for that. That while it is incredibly egregious what is happening right now, the bottom line is there's so many platforms to get our stories and our narratives out. And you're seeing increasingly communities of color. We're seeing station, we're seeing entire networks come up. I think we've got to lean into that. I think part of what is happening is a reaction unto the loss of white control. The bottom line is there are millions of people around the world that have shown that they have an appetite for new stories, stories that are reflective of who really makes America. And that is the space that I think is going to give us hope. We need to lean into it, buckle up, because it's going to be a hard ride. right? But I certainly believe that we're going to get to the other side.
Yes. Don't give up, people. Don't give up. Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. Dr. Christina Greer, associate professor of political science at Fordham University. Thank you so much for bringing me up today. I really appreciate it. And thank you for joining me on this episode of In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Uno. Remember, dear listener, to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because where else are you going to hear three powerful women having this kind of political conversation? So do that now. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family to listen. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saadi, Harsha Nahata, Lisa Salinas, and our fellow Sarah Hershander, with editorial support from Charlotte Mann. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kep and ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Have a great week. Bye! Hold on one second. We got a dog situation.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.